couple of weeks ago, some of you heard the message that I gave. It was titled Priests, Living Stones, and Living Sacrifices. And it turned into part one. So I'll just kind of briefly go over what I talked about in that message. And that, a few weeks back, a couple of members were discussing, well, what does it mean to be a priest in the kingdom of God? Somewhere it says we'll be kings and priests. And so it was an interesting conversation. But, I was really kind of caught like a deer in the headlights. I was like, I really need to know more about that. And that's a good question. So we went over what it means to be priests by looking at the Old Testament. What did it mean to be a priest then? So we'll kind of talk about that a little bit and kind of review some of that before I get into part two of this message today. So we did gain some insight, into what the priest did then. And they had responsibilities that included similar to the responsibilities of a public health official today and building inspectors and teachers and judges and all kinds of things that priests were responsible for under the old covenant. So some of the key scriptures that still tie in today, in today's message, are Revelation 5, 9, and 10. And this is talking about the future, of course, which much of Revelation talks about, as well as including some things that have happened. So Revelation 5, 9, and 10, you can turn there if you wish. There's a few differences in some of the translations in one particular section of this scripture. So Revelation 5, 9 says, "And they sang a new song, saying, You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Now that's the English Standard Version. I believe in the King James and the New King James it says kings and priests. Also the New Living Translation says kingdom of priests. And commentaries basically say that is a better translation, kingdom of priests. And that kind of ties into something that makes sense. Because in the Old Testament, in Exodus, if you want to turn there, Exodus 19, verses 4 through 6. Exodus 19, verses 4 through 6. "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So God wanted ancient Israel to show the rest of the world how a nation should behave and honor and obey God. And we know how that went. So we talked about a possible reason God chose out of the tribe of Levi a formal priesthood instead of choosing any other tribe in Israel. We explored the sacrificial duties of the priests, learned they had many other duties. I just talked about that, being educators as well as many other things. So today, I'm going to talk about a legal case involving the priesthood and the importance of its role for us to, come to have a better understanding maybe of what this kingdom of priests is about. And there will be a part three. I thought I could get through all this in part two, so hang on. We will be going back and forth between the Old and New Testaments a little bit to get a good sense of the importance of the priesthood. God spoke to Aaron and gave him very specific instructions for the priesthood. Let's look at that again. It's Leviticus 10. Leviticus 10. Verses 8 through 11. Leviticus 10, verses 8 through 11. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, "Do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, and between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses." So they were tasked with the responsibility of teaching all of Israel the difference between the holy and unholy and the clean and the unclean. And God commanded the priesthood to teach his people the law. So on down the road, we see what happens when the priesthood fails to meet this objective, which is, you know, God's directive. It talks about Asa's religious reforms and why those reforms were necessary in 2 Chronicles. That's 2 Chronicles 15, 1 through 3. 2 Chronicles 15, 1 through 3. And a man of God came to King Asa to tell him what he should do, and he listened. So 2 Chronicles 15, 1 through 3. "Now the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And when he went out to meet Asa and said to him, 'Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin, the Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you.'" So, just before the next verse, you know, Israel had forsaken God. The priests had forsaken their duties in teaching Israel what they should do and holding them to the line. So verse 3, "For a long time Israel has been without the true God, without a teaching priest, and without the law." So you can sure see the consequences in effect today. In our nation and in the world, that results from not being taught God's law and obeying God. A priesthood that is holy and obeys God and teaches his law to the people and judges rightly results in a nation being blessed. Now, let's look at Malachi 2, 7 through 9. Malachi 2, 7 through 9. This is something priests should do. "For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you have departed from the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore I also have made you contemptible and base before all the people, because you have not kept my ways, but have shown partiality in the law." So the priest should keep knowledge, and they should teach the truth in the law as God has taught them, and be messengers of the Lord instead of messengers of whatever they feel like telling people for their own gain, which unfortunately happens way too often. So, brethren, we are the ones God has chosen to reflect God's truth, to teach God's truth, to be examples of what the results are of living God's law in our lives. Now, we're going to take a little look into something that happened as a result of God choosing Moses to lead Israel and Aaron and the tribe of Levi for the priesthood. So you might have an idea where I'm going with this. I call it a legal case for a reason. We'll look into that a little bit. You know, I was recently called to jury duty. I got the jury summons and all that. And many months ago, I put in a deferral request, or I heard that if you put in for December, nothing will happen. Well, with my luck, something happened, and they called me up to appear for jury duty. And it was supposed to be a 5-day trial, and I prayed about it a lot, and I got dismissed. So, attorneys didn't like me, judge didn't like me. They as now, if you have this unconscious bias or bias about this matter, raise your hand. And it was very true, I did. There's some unfortunate history in my past. So I'm grateful that I got out of there. But in a courtroom, it's very serious. And you can't wear your hats. They tell you got to take your hats off. You can have some water, but don't be, you know, eating a cheeseburger in there. And there's plaintiffs. Those are the ones who bring a lawsuit because they have a grievance. They feel they have been injured in some way. There's property damage. They have had physical, mental harm, something where they feel they have a right to sue the other party. So the party being sued is called a defendant. And then, of course, you have the judge that oversees the trial and makes a decision based on the jury's decision. Often, sometimes it's just the judge. It depends. So anyway, you'll see in a bit why I bring up the plaintiff and the defendant. We're going to look into something that happened as a result of God choosing Moses to lead Israel and Aaron and the tribe of Levi for the priesthood. I read that, but just to let you know where we're going. If you establish something new in a society, there are challenges, right? Think about Roe versus Wade and the incredible division that decision has made in our society. You have many challenges when big changes are made. They're not readily accepted. And we've had the recent changes, you know, regarding, you know, who and when can get abortions and where and all that stuff. When the Romans conquered and occupied Jerusalem, the priesthood was dramatically changed to the point where the office of priest could be purchased. That's not the way it had been for a very long time. You couldn't just buy the office of a priest. But that happened after the Roman occupation. So today, when someone believes they suffered damages or injury, they file the lawsuit. But a judge reviews that lawsuit and determines if it has standing. In the papers that are filed, did it prove that they had a basis to claim that they had suffered damages? And sometimes the judge will just deny the lawsuit because it doesn't have merit or it's even frivolous. Somebody's just out to get money and they haven't suffered damages. So it's been about 4,000 years since a case or a lawsuit occurred. The injured party in the lawsuit today is called a plaintiff, as we discussed, and the party being sued is called a defendant. We're going to look at Korah's rebellion. In Numbers 16, we're going to go back and forth a little bit, but we'll be in Numbers quite a bit. And bear with me, because you will see why I bring this up after a while. So, number 16, let's look at verses 1 through 3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. So it's not just Levi here. It's also involving Reuben, as well as others, you will see. So, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. So these weren't a bunch of misfits and troublemakers. These were honored leaders, men of renown. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" So here we see Korah and other Levites withstanding, and other leaders from the congregation. Not just Levites, they were from other tribes as well. So these were the plaintiffs, and they were presenting a verbal lawsuit against Moses and Aaron, the defendants. What Korah claimed resonated with 250 leaders, men of renown. You know, Moses and Aaron were tasked with passing on the Lord's decisions and instructions. Korah said, "You take too much upon yourselves." And it resonated with the congregation, many in Israel, believe this as well. So there has been a priesthood system around for a long time, from the time before God designated the Levites as a priesthood and Aaron and his sons as the leaders in that priesthood. Let's look at Genesis 8. You know that one of the roles of a priest is to do what? Present burnt offerings. The focal point of one of the most important duties of a priest is the altar. So let's look at Genesis 8, verse 20 to 22. That's Genesis 8, 20 to 22. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. So he built an altar. And he took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. So Noah had performed a priestly duty, built an altar, and made sacrifices to God. Let's look at Genesis 12, just a few chapters later. Guess who else built an altar to the Lord? Genesis 12, 7 through 8. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. We see, he built an altar to the Lord. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, forgive me on it. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram is filling that priestly function of building an altar to God and he making sacrifices. Isaac served the same function. So this is happening, you know, from one generation to another. In Genesis 26, you can see that. I'm not going to read it or have you turn there. Genesis 26 is about Isaac building an altar. So who comes after Isaac? Then comes Jacob, who was also named Israel. In Genesis 46, not 26, Genesis 46, 1 through 3. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God, to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation. So Jacob also offered sacrifices to God. So with this background, what do we see? We see that a patriarch of the clan was the one that offered sacrifices and built the altars to God. He was the leader of his clan, of his people. So the plaintiffs in the case, Korah and Israelite leaders versus Moses and Aaron. We see lawsuits, the case, you know, and they give case numbers and things. So this is Korah and Israelite leaders versus Moses and Aaron. They believe that the precedence of an established priesthood system wherein the right of priesthood was that of the patriarchs of each clan. God said he gave the right of a priesthood to the Levites, and tribal leaders no longer held that position. So they became plaintiffs and sued Moses and Aaron, who became the defendants. There's something else at play here. Have you heard of church culture? You can have a certain culture in church. You can even have a certain culture in different congregations. Read about the seven churches in Revelation. So, over time, we grow in our spiritual maturity, I hope that part, and jettison what we may have is called a bad attitude, that we can get into and beat back questioners. How dare you ask that? And you get a bad attitude. That's not the right approach. Hopefully, with God's Holy Spirit, we come to recognize our own bad attitude rather than pointing the finger. That bad attitude factor comes into play in Numbers 16:3. So, I'll read this again, Numbers 16:3. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them. And the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" Moses didn't turn down their case because they had standing. He turned it down because they brought their case and a bad attitude. Or, using slang, they had a bad-itude. You don't want to have a bad attitude. It's called a bad-itude. Right now, the point is the case. What is the case brought forward? Numbers 16:3 lays it out, and that key statement in there, "You take too much upon yourselves," is at the core of this case. And some commentaries say a better translation would be "enough for you." Moses had been the leader. He brought them out of Egypt. He brought the Ten Commandments down, and Aaron, you know, was this high priest, and he said, "You guys got enough. It's our turn," right? Adam Clark's commentary on the Holy Bible, abridged by Ralph Earle, puts it this way. "The spirit of this saying appears to me to be the following. Holy offices are not equally distributed. You arrogate," and I had to look that up and now know what arrogate meant, "it's to take or claim without justification. You arrogate to yourself the most important ones, as if your superior holiness entitled you alone to them, whereas all the congregation are holy and have an equal right with you to be employed in the most holy services." So they're saying, "Your time's up, Moses." This is not the quote now. "Enough for you. You led us out of Egypt. Now it's our turn to lead because we are holy." So they're getting this from Exodus 19 at Mount Sinai when God said, "You shall be a holy nation," you know, a priesthood. There were some ifs in there. You know, that was a general statement, you see. There were certain conditions that had to be met, and there was God's timing for when that would happen. And this is a specific statement where God made Aaron and his sons in charge of the Levite priesthood and gave them the higher duties. You know, did Moses lobby to be the man in charge? Did he run as a candidate for the supreme office of the nation of Israel? Did he really want it bad? No. He did not want that office. In fact, initially he made it clear to God he wasn't qualified for the job at all. God also said, what about Moses? In Numbers 12:3, you don't have to turn there. "Now Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth." Meek is another word that's used, but its meaning is humble, not, you know, incapable of leading people at all or being a coward or anything like that. So God chose Moses. He did not make himself leader. Moses was the one God worked with every step of the way. Let's look at Exodus 19:5-6 again. Exodus 19:5-6. "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So Korah is using this for his own purposes and self-gain. God did not remove Moses when he said Israel would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This was and is God's ultimate intention. So let's look at 1 Peter now in the New Testament, looking forward again into the future, 1 Peter 2, verses 9 through 10. There's another word that's thrown in here about the priesthood. 1 Peter 2, 9 through 10. "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, so it's also a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. So, Peter's talking about God's chosen. The ones he's called out of the world, doesn't matter if they're physical beings from the physical tribes of Israel. He's addressing both Jews and Gentiles. This is whoever God has called out of the world to his marvelous truth. So again, if we look at Revelation 5, 8 through 10, the New Living Translation. That's verse 10 I'll read, Revelation 5, verse 10. And you have caused them to become a kingdom of priests for our God, and they will reign on the earth. And then before that, in verse 9, who are these people? I'll just read the last sentence. For you were slaughtered, and your blood has ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And then verse 10, and you have caused them to become a kingdom of priests for our God, and they will reign on the earth. So God has called us out of this world just as he called Israel out of Egypt. And we've been called out of different nations, not just the 12 tribes. So this case is essentially pitting two decrees against each other. Okay? God decreed that Aaron and his family were formally assigned the priesthood. Number two, God decreed that Israel shall be a kingdom of priests. Korah believed that all Israel had the rights of the priesthood, that the patriarchs, leaders, they had those rights. Moses, in essence, recused himself as he could not be both the defendant and the judge in this matter. Moses gave his opinion. He wasn't real happy with what Korah and the plaintiffs were saying. But he turned the decision over to God as the judge. Now remember, attitude was highly relevant in this case. God does take attitudes into consideration when he makes judgments. You know, let's think about it. Sometimes you may be right about something, but you lose out because of a bad attitude. Remember what we're instructed to do when someone asks us to give the reason for the hope that lies within us, to make a defense for it. Well, you stupid idiot, this is the truth, and that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to give an answer in meekness and fear. So you can tell the truth, but you can do it in the wrong way, see? You got to have a righteous attitude. You've got to be humble. Our Savior was. He wants us to be like him. So I don't think that character trait is displayed at all by Korah and the other plaintiffs. I'm not seeing a righteous and humble attitude. Korah's gang wanted to be in charge and decide who sacrifices, when they sacrifice, and how it should be made, and what, you know, everybody under their authority should do. They would be the decision makers, right? When we're talking in management, you know, who's the decision maker? That's the one I want to talk to. You want to get something done. But God chooses who he puts in charge of what. Remember that in Genesis 48 and 49, that Reuben had the blessing reserved for the firstborn removed from him because of his adultery. Adultery's bad enough, but this was a really disgusting adultery. That was the firstborn's right, yet God took it from him. You know, the blessings, special blessings, the best ones are reserved for the firstborn. But God took it away. It's God's right to bless whom he pleases and how. God chose to give the greatest firstborn's blessings to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And then he switched, you know, hands when Jacob gave the blessing. Manasseh was Joseph's firstborn, but God wanted the greater blessing to go to Ephraim. And so Jacob did what God inspired him to do. God's in charge. If you don't accept that and fight against it, it just doesn't work out. So, Korah's gang. Korah's gang felt angry over being displaced, passed up, stepped over. Korah was saying he had the same rights as Moses, and it was his turn, right? And those of his followers. You know, a climber, you know, climb a ladder, feels jilted when they're passed over. Korah felt he deserved the preeminence. Preeminence is, you know, superiority. You are superior to that person that got promoted. And you feel jilted. You get angry. So, Korah is pleading his case as the plainest believed. The general statement, the decree that you will be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, took precedence over the specific statement that Aaron and his sons were over the priesthood. So Moses brought the matter before God. And let's see what happens here. Numbers 16, verses 16 to 17. Numbers 16, verses 16 to 17. And Moses said to Korah, "You and all your followers must come here tomorrow and present yourselves before the Lord. Aaron will also be here. You and each of your 250 followers must prepare an incense burner and put incense on it so you can all present them before the Lord. Aaron will also bring his incense burner." Now, incense burners took a little bit of time to make. And he's telling them, bring your incense burners tomorrow morning, or tomorrow, anyway. Where did the 250 followers get incense burners? They already had them. They had all been priests and had the incense burners already. They were the leaders of their clans and the tribes. And number 16:6. Korah, you and all your followers must prepare your incense burners. So we look back earlier. They already had incense burners to prepare. So Korah had stirred up the whole congregation against Moses and Aaron, we read in verse 19, and they gathered before the tabernacle entrance. Korah was a divisive force. I put it in bold. He was a divisive force. He wasn't the kind of person God wanted in charge of the priesthood that was supposed to be his messenger and serve him and God's people. Korah was a divisive force seeking to try this case in a court of public opinion. Sounds like a typical politician to me. You want to be popular with the crowd and get the decision swayed in your favor in spite of what the decision should really be. You know, God doesn't care about public opinion. We've sure seen some poor results of majority rule in our country so many times. So we know the result of God's judgment against Korah and his gang of followers. Moses and Aaron pleaded with God to show mercy and not destroy the entire congregation. God was not happy with the bad attitude going on with Korah and how he swayed most of the congregation of Israel toward his viewpoint. So God listened and narrowed it down where he wasn't going to destroy all the congregation. However, his judgment was swift and devastating. You know, originally our justice system, our justice was supposed to be swift. It was, but it's not anymore. You hear about people on death row for years and years of agonizing solitude in prisons and things, and there's not swift justice these days. Moses asked God to perform a judgment that was entirely new so that the congregation would know it was from God and not from Moses. So Numbers 16, 32 and 35, Numbers 16, verse 32 and 35, here's the new thing that happened. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed the men. Not only that, all of their households and all their followers who were standing with them and everything they owned. Then, verse 35, the fire blazed forth from the Lord and burned up the 250 men These were men of renown, remember, who were offering incense. So they were there. They had their incense burners. But it gets really interesting now. We were aware of God's righteous and judgment against these rebels. But this is interesting. In verse 37, 38, tell Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, to pull all the incense burners from the fire, for they are holy. Also tell him to scatter the burning coals. Take the incense burners of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives and hammer the metal into a thin sheet to overlay the altar. Since these burners were used in the Lord's presence, they have become holy. Let them serve as a warning to the people of Israel. So they saw these hammered out incense burners at the altar. Every time they brought a sin offering, a burnt offering, whatever offering on that altar, there's that reminder. What happens when people sin and rebel against God? And did they pay any attention whatsoever? Not very often. You know, some really scary and awful stuff just happened, right? They saw fire come down and consume 250 people, the congregation, right? They ran away. They were scared to death when the earth opened up and swallowed all the rebels, their households, their belongings. They didn't want to get swallowed up. Let's flee lest we die. Then what? The very next morning, the congregation blames Moses and Aaron, saying, "You've killed the Lord's people." They must have been smoking hashish or something. They just saw this horrible judgment that God enacted upon the rebels. So God struck them with a deadly plague. 14,700 of them died before God stopped the plague. And that put an end, finally, to their whining for the time being. So Aaron's staff buds. I'm going to talk about this now a little bit. Number 17, the next chapter. God tells each tribe to bring the rod of each tribal leader with the name of that leader inscribed on the rod. And Aaron would also have a rod with his name inscribed on it. And they were to place these in front of the Ark of the Covenant, in front of the tabernacle. God said buds would sprout on the rod of the man that he would choose as the head of the priesthood. The next day after the rods were in place in front of the Ark of the Covenant, Aaron's rod not only had buds on it, but blossomed and grew ripe almonds. So I looked it up, and it usually takes 7 to 8 months for a healthy almond tree to produce ripe almonds. These were rods that had been used by the leaders for who knows how long, hardened, weathered, dead wood. And the very next morning, not only did Aaron's rod bud, but it had blossoms and ripe almonds. It was obviously an incredible miracle, and nobody else's rod had anything on it. So God selected Aaron's rod to reside in the tabernacle. God let Israel know in no uncertain terms. He made his choice for the high priest and for the sons of Aaron to rule the priesthood. So what's the whole point of all this? It didn't matter if you were the oldest son to be a priest. God chooses who that is. God is preparing us to be a kingdom of priests, the younger siblings of Jesus Christ, our high priest, no longer an Aaronic priesthood. What will our job be in the millennium? Well, stay tuned for part 3 of Priests, Living Stones, and Living Sacrifices to find out.